We're on Chesamid Aleph, the seventh wide line, beginning the new Mishnah. Our Masechta began with the rabbinic decree that prohibited commerce with idol worshippers within 3 days of their pagan festivals, either out of concern that transaction might make him feel glad and that will cause him to go and praise his idol, or possibly the concern is that, you know, let's say you're selling him an animal, so that might be supplying his animal he's going to bring as a sacrifice on his idolatrous festival. The Mishnah today offers some examples of pagan festivals, and we'll learn that there are some like more minor joyous occasions where the halacha is not as strict. Mishnah begins, Ve'elu Eideyen Shalov Dekochav. The following would be examples of pagan festivals of idolaters. We have Kalenda, and we have Usitarnura, Ukaratesim. And the Gemara will elaborate on these pagan festivals. In addition, another day that is of concern that would be subject to this rabbinic decree is V'yom Genusia Shel Malchea, the Genusia day of their king. The Gemara will define what this term Genusia is. In addition, there is V'yom Haleda, V'yom Hamisa, the birthday of the king and the day on which the king died. Commemoration will be held on that day, and included idolatrous sacrifices. And so that day would be subject to the same halacha as well of a prohibition against commerce 3 days before all these days. These are the words of Rabbi Meir. However, regarding this last case of Yom HaMisa, the yahrzeit, if you will, of the idolatrous king, the Chachamim state the distinction regarding this day. The Chachamim say, Kol Misa Sheyesh Basreifa, if the king's yahrzeit included a ceremony of burning some of the deceased king's possessions, which was a sign of mourning and respect for that king, then that would be a sign that they are indeed commemorating that anniversary of the king's death in a serious way. And as such, it's presumable that Yesh Ba'avodas Kochavim, they will also be worshipping their idol on that day, and therefore would be subject to our rabbinic decree. However, Vishain Ba'asreifa, if burning the king's possessions is not included in the ceremonies of the day, even if there's some kind of commemoration, we assume it's not a very serious one, and therefore ein ba'avodas kochavim, we assume that worshipping the idol will not be part of the day, and so it would not be subject to the rabbinic decree. The Mishnah continues that in all of the above cases, the rabbinic decree of 3 days before the festival applies, that we may not conduct business transactions with pagans. The Mishnah says, now, avol yom tikalacha zikano beluriso. However, if you're talking about more of like a personal celebration, for example, they had some kind of ceremony when a pagan would shave off his beard, or his beluris, the hair, you know, grown long in the back, was also an idolatrous practice, or v'yom sha'alabo minayam, or let's say this pagan has a day of personal celebration upon your returning from going overseas, being out to sea, v'yom shi'atzam v'beisa asurin, or the day got released from prison, or v'yovi kochavim shi'asa mishta libino, or for example, a pagan has a wedding celebration for his son. Says the Mishnah, although it would be common for pagans to, on these different occasions, bring idolatrous sacrifices. However, in terms of the rabbinic decree of our perek, Einu osur ala oso hayom v'oso ish bilvat. The rabbinic prohibition against engaging in commerce with this person would only apply on the day of. On the day of that personal celebration, it would be an issue to transact business with this pagan, but not on the days before. And it also only applies to the person himself, the Bal Simcha. Specifically with him, the Rabbana would say, you know, not to transact the business with him. And we don't say that one cannot transact business with any of his associates either. That may be, if you give them, let's say, an animal, it will end up by this person who will bring it as an idolatrous sacrifice. Now, the rabbinic decree does not go beyond the person himself making the joyous occasion, and it only applies on the day of that joyous occasion. The Gemara elaborates on the first two pagan festivals mentioned in the Mishnah of Kalenda and the Starnura, which is related to the god they worshipped, Saturn. The Gemara says, Amar Rav Chanan bar Rava, Kalenda shmoni yomim machar tekufa. Kalenda was an 8-day festival observed after the winter solstice. Starnura shmoni yom lifnei tekufa. So Tarnura was observed for 8 days prior to the winter solstice. course, the winter solstice marks the day when the short days of the winter start to get long again. And the Gemara provides v'simanach, a siman to help you remember which one is which, and one should recall the pasuk in Tehillim. Kuf Lamed Tes, which says, Achar v'kedem tzartani, later and before you formed me. So we see in this pasuk how the term achar, like after, later, is mentioned first. So this could help us remember that the first pagan festival mentioned in our Mishnah of Kalenda actually refers to the pagan festival that was observed after the winter solstice, with Starnura being observed before it. The Gemara now reveals the origins of this pagan festival. The Brice here relates that these festivals actually had legitimate origins, had your roots in a festival observed by Adam HaRishon, who observed these as festivals, L'shem Shemaim, for the sake of heaven, but later eventually became corrupted, and the pagans co-opted this festival for their idolatrous purposes. Tanu Rabbanan. The Rabbanan taught in a Brisa, and this is what happened. L'fisha ra Adam HaRishon yom she'tismayit v'holech. During the first winter after creation, Adam HaRishon alarmingly observed how the days were getting shorter and shorter. Amar, he said, Oy li, shema b'shvil shesarachti olam choshech ba'di v'chozeh l'tov avo. He said that it appears, woe to me, it appears that because I sinned, that now the world is gradually getting darker and darker, and it's headed back to tov avo. Of utter nothingness, the world, it seems, will cease to exist. This apparently is the meaning of the death that was decreed upon me as a consequence of my sin of eating from the tree of knowledge. And so, Amad v'yashav shemoni yamim b'taynes b'tfila. 8 days before the winter solstice, Adam HaRishon fasted and prayed that whole time. Kivin shirat tekufas teves v'rayam shemarech v'holech. But then, when he saw the pendulum begin to swing, it was Tekufas Teves, the winter solstice, and the days started getting longer. Omar, he realized, he said, Min hagu shel olamo. Evidently, this is simply the way that Hashem set up the world. This is one of the cycles of God's creation. And so Adam was overjoyed that the world would not cease to exist after all. And out of his great joy, halach v'yasa shmoni yomim tovim, he observed the following 8 days after the winter solstice as a festival. And l'shana acheres asan leilu leilu yomim tovim. The following year, he converted those 8 days that the previous year he had spent fasting and dreading the end of the world. Now he turned that whole period, both periods of 8 days, into a joyous festival. The Braisa remarks, Hu kavam l'shem shemayim, though Adam HaRishon clearly designated these days to be a festival for the sake of heaven. V'heim kavum l'shem avodas kochavim. The pagans took these days, these festivals, and decided to repurpose them to celebrate, to serve their idols. Gemara has a question about the above narrative, which is, Bishlama l'madi amar b'tishrei nivra ha'olam. The above narrative makes perfect sense according to the opinion that the world was created in the month of Tishrei. The world was created in the fall. Therefore, indeed, Yumazuti Chaza, Yumarichi Akati Lo Chaza. In that first year after creation, Adam HaRishon had only experienced short days, winter days. He had not yet experienced long summer days. And therefore, Adam didn't have any indication. This was a pattern, a cycle of the world, that the length of the days, you know, changed throughout the year. Ela Leman Yomar Benisa Nivra Olam. But according to the other opinion, this is a dispute brought in Masechtas Rosh Hashanah. The other opinion there says that the world was created in the month of Nisan. The question is, Hachazale Yumazuti V'yumarichi. Why was Adam HaRishon so mystified here? Why, according to this opinion, by the time it was winter, Adam HaRishon had already observed this phenomenon. For if the world was created in Nisan, that means the world was created in the spring. And so Adam HaRishon had already experienced short days in the spring and the long days of the summer. So this, you know, kind of change was not a new phenomenon. So why did Adam HaRishon panic and feel so alarmed that the world was coming to an end? The Gemara answers, the Havi Zute Kulehai Lochaza. True, Adam HaRishon, according to this opinion, had seen the shorter spring days. Certainly the spring days are shorter than the summer days. He had not yet seen the days get that short as they get in the winter. And therefore it did seem to Adam HaRishon that the world was just getting darker and darker, less and less daylight. Apparently the world is coming to an end. This is the knas, this is the punishment for my sin. He assumed the worst and therefore began to fast and pray. The Gemara brings a related braisa, Tana Rabbanan, and the Rabbanan taught Nei braisa, at Yom Shenivra Bo Adam Harishon. On the day Adam Harishon was created, Kivin Sheshaka Lov Chamo, Adam Harishon saw that the sun was setting, the world was getting darker. It's the first time he had seen such a thing. Amar Oili Shemishvil Shesharachti Olam Choshech Badi V'yachsu Olam L'tov Avo. He said, that's it, the world's coming to an end. Everything is turning back to complete nothingness. V'zui Misa Shenikneso Alay Min Hashamayim. This apparently is the decree of death that was decreed upon me for my sin. We know that Adam Rishon sinned on the first day that he was created. So when after the sin he saw the world was getting dark, he said, that's it, the world will cease to exist. And therefore, Hayyoshev Betainus, he sat in fasting, Ubocha Kalalaila, and wept the whole night. Vichava Bocha Kenegdo, with his wife Eve crying opposite him. But then, Kivin Sha'olah Omer Shachar, when the sun in the morning came up again, Omer Minhago Shalolamhu. And Amarisha realized that this is simply one of the cycles that Hashem built into the world. The sun should set and rise each day. And so out of thanksgiving, Omad v'hikriv shor shekarnav kodmin leparso sav. The Marishan arose and brought a carbon. And for the sacrifice, he brought a shor, an ox, whose horns preceded its hooves. And what does that mean? It means that this ox had been formed as part of Maisa Bereishis, as opposed to an ox that was born, you know, after Maisa Bereishis. Now, since it was created along with the rest of Maisa Bereishis, it, like everything else created, was created fully mature, with horns and everything. And therefore, it's described as its horns came before the hooves. That is, when God formed it from the earth, since it already had the horns, and, you know, that's, you know, higher up on the body, that came out of the ground first. So Adam Harishon made sure to bring this kind of animal for his Thanksgiving sacrifice. Shenemar, and this is alluded to in Tehillim, where David HaMelech prays, V'sitav LaHashem Mishor Par Makrin Mafris. David HaMelech asks Hashem that his prayer should be even more pleasing than the sacrifice of the Shor Par. We have this interesting name given to the animal, that it's an ox, and it's a par, and it's a bull. Now, in Chumash, the difference between a Shor and a par is that whereas we could call even a one-day-old ox a shor, we wouldn't call it a par until it's at least 3 years old. And so what David HaMelech meant by this is we have this animal that on the one hand it's shor, it's only a day old, but it's still called par because it was created as a fully mature bull. And also we have the order here of makrin mafris, so first the horn, then the hoof. So it's alluding to the sacrifice of Adam. David HaMelech is saying that my prayer should be even more pleasing than the very special sacrifice that Adam HaRishon brought and that was described above. And more about Adam's carbon here. V'yamrav Yehuda Amar Shmuel, Shor Shehikriv Adam HaRishon. The ox referred to that Adam HaRishon brought as a sacrifice when he realized that the world was not coming to an end. Karen Achas Hoysalo B'mitzcho. It had just one horn coming out of its forehead. Shenemar. This is alluded to in the Pasuk in Tehillim that we cited above, which says, V'sitav LaHashem Yishar Par Makrid Mafris. The Gemara wonders how this language indicates it only had one horn. The opposite, Makrin Tarti Mashma. The way we read this word, Makrin, it's horned, implies it was like any other animal with horns that had two horns. The Gemara answers, Amar Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak, Mi Keren Ksiv. The drash here is based on the fact that the way this word is actually spelled in the Pasuk allows for the pronunciation of Mi Keren, which would mean one horn. So indeed, that's how we expound it. This unique animal had just one horn coming out of its forehead. The Gemara now has a question about one of the pagan festivals mentioned in our Mishnah. It changed the next word to Ba'i Rav Masna, Romi Shiosisa Kalenda. We know that Kalenda was a pagan festival observed by Rome. So the question is, if Rome observes Kalenda, V'koli Yaris Asmuchos La Mishtablos La, we also have the cities surrounding Rome, which are subjugated by Rome. They pay taxes to Rome. However, these citizens of the surrounding cities do not observe Kalenda. So the question is, Osani Yaris Asuros Amutaros, would these surrounding cities be included in the prohibition of transacting business with them within 3 days of Kalenda? The potential argument that even regarding these cities, it's a problem is that, let's say, you go and sell them animals, or maybe those animals, you know, since, you know, they in turn will do business with Rome, will end up in Roman hands on their pagan festival, which they'll use for idolatrous sacrifices. Maybe it's a problem even regarding these cities. The Gemara says we have two different opinions on this. Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi Amar Kalenda Asura La Kolhi. Shmuel Levi contends that the prohibition applies even to the surrounding cities that are taxed by Rome, that do business with Rome. But Rabbi Yochanan Amar Ein Asura Ela Liyovdea Milvat. Rabbi Yochanan argues, he says, not true. Rather, the rabbinic prohibition will only apply to the citizens of Rome itself who actually observe the pagan holiday of Kalenda. Gemara says, Tanya Kavuse the Rabbi Yochanan, the Braisa that supports Rabbi Yochanan's opinion. For says the Braisa Afal Pisha Amru Romi Asasa Kalenda Vikol Yarasas Muchas La Mishtabdos La. Even though Rome itself observes Kalenda, and you have these cities that are subjugated by Rome, nevertheless, hi atzma ena asura ela liyovdea bilvad. The prohibition only applies to the people of Rome who actually observe Kalenda. So this brisa is clearly like Rabbi Yochanan. The brisa continues, Saturnalia ukratesim, regarding the pagan festivals of Saturnalia and Kartesim, as well as Yom Genusia Shamalchem, this other Yom Genusia of the king, we'll talk about that, V'yom Shehumloch Bo Melech, and the day that was celebrated for being the day on which the king was coronated, says the Braisa, Lifan of Asur. So 3 days before these festivals, the rabbinic prohibition against the commerce with idolaters will apply. However, Acharav Mutter, commerce with the idolaters after these festivals is permitted. The Rabbanan did not extend the prohibition to the days after the festivals. The Braisa continues, V'yovei kochavim, she'asa mishta lebino. Let's say a pagan is making a wedding feast for his son. Ein asra la'osa yom v'osa yish. As our Mishnah had mentioned, here the rabbinic prohibition becomes significantly lighter, less restrictive in that it only applies on the day of and to that individual who is making the celebration. Gemara continues, Amar Rav Ashi, Afana Nami Tanina. Rabbi Yochanan's view that these surrounding cities of Rome that pay taxes to Rome but don't themselves observe Kalenda, that the prohibition would not apply to them, is also implied by our Mishnah, Diktani, for our Mishnah taught us, Yom Tiglacha Zikano Bloriso V'yom Shialam Minayam V'yom Shiatza B'mimesa Surin. Regarding these various days of like personal celebration for an individual pagan, Ein aser lo osa yom belvad v'yoso ish. The rabbinic prohibition would apply only on the day of that celebration where it's possible he'll bring idolatrous sacrifices and only to that individual. So Rav Ashi makes the following point. Bishlama osa hayom. We understand the Mishnah's point of emphasizing that the prohibition here only applies on the day of the celebration. It's clear what the intent there is. Liafuke lefana v'liacharav. The Mishnah is saying, as opposed to that the prohibition would extend to the days before or after these kinds of celebrations. Ella, oso ha'ish la'afuke mai. Rav Ashi says, what's the point of saying that the prohibition only applies to that person who is hosting the celebration? I mean, obviously, if you have a person who has nothing to do with the celebration in question, obviously the whole issue is irrelevant. You know, what could possibly be the concern? Obviously, it's only, you know, as far as the person who is actually conducting the celebration. So, you know, if you do business with him, and then he might bring his idolatrous sacrifice. So, by that person, there's an issue. So, what is the Mishnah really coming to point out here? So, Rav Ashi says, "Lav liafuke mishubadav." Apparently, the Mishnah's point is the prohibition only applies to the host himself, as opposed to his subordinates, you know, people who serve him in some capacity. That I might have said, the rabbinic prohibition against commerce should apply even to them, because if, for example, you know, they are supplied with an animal, then they might in turn give it to this person who is making a wedding celebration, whatever the celebration is, and they'll bring it as an idolatrous sacrifice. The Mishnah is teaching us that no, the Rabbanan never extended their decree to Meshubad of those were subordinate to him. Gemara reasons are the same is presumably true when you're talking about different communities. You have one community that is observing a day as an idolatrous celebration. There's other outlying communities that are subordinate to that central community. We see from the Mishnah that the Rabbanan did not say that, you know, we have to be concerned that if you supply the surrounding communities, then it's going to end up by the idolatrous community. We see that Rabbanan did not go that far in their legislation here. Shema Mina. Indeed, it's clear from the Mishnah too, like Rabbi Yochanan's view on this. And again, the prohibition will only apply to Rome itself, let's say on the festival of Calenda, not to the surrounding cities who themselves don't observe the festival. Mara continues now, Tanya says in a brisa, Rabbi changed to Shimon ben Elazar Omer, Yisrael asher b'chutz laretz ovdei avodas kochavim b'taharahein. He makes a startling declaration. He says, the Jews outside of Eretz Yisrael are performing idol worship, b'tahara, impurity, like without realizing it, they are doing an act which is considered avodah zarah, idol worship. Ketzad. How? He says, because if ovi kochavim she'asem mishta libino, if let's say there's an idolater who's making a wedding celebration for his son, v'zimein kol ha'yehudim she'vi'iro, he invites everybody in the city, including the Jews in the city, to the celebration, and they accept the invitation, and they join the celebration, afal pi she'ochlim mishelahen, v'shosim mishelahen, v'shamish shelahen omei lifneim, even if these Jews are careful to have their own food and drink, they have their own caterer, their own waiter, nevertheless, since there are idolatrous sacrifices going on at that celebration, the pasuk considers this action, this participation in idolatrous celebration, as if these Jewish attendants actually participated in the idolatrous sacrifice, which is termed zivchei mesim, sacrifices of the dead. You know, a derogatory way to refer to the idolatrous sacrifices. Shenemar, this is indicated in the pasuk, which says, "V'kara lecha v'yochalta mizivcha." Pasuk warns of the Canaanite influence. It says, "A pagan from the Canaanite people will go and invite you to eat from his sacrifice." So we see it's like eating from their sacrifice. But the Gemara asks, "V'yema de'ochel?" How does the pasuk show that merely by attending the event that includes an idolatrous sacrifice, that is considered like eating from it? Why not say that it means that literally, you only, you know, comes to that point, so they considered, you know, that severe of a sin if he actually eats from that idolatrous sacrifice? The Gemara responds, Amar Rava, im kein, nei makra v'yochalta mizivcho, mai v'kara lecha. If that were so, then let the pasuk simply say that this Kanani might have you eat from his idolatrous sacrifice. Why does it mention at all that he will invite you? The answer is to teach us that the Jews already considered in violation of this, and like participating in this idolatrous sacrifice, Mishas Kriya, as soon as he's invited and he accepts the invitation and attends, he's already considered to have eaten from Zivche Mesim, from these idolatrous sacrifices. The Gemara says, Hilkach, therefore, turning to Amid Beis, the way it works is, Kol Tlasin Yomin, throughout a period of 30 days following an idolater's wedding celebration, Bein Amrle Machmas Hilulo, Bein Lo Amrle Machmas Hilulo Aser. Regardless of whether the idolater actually mentions that he is having this feast to celebrate the recent marriage of his son, either way, asur will be prohibited for a Jew to attend this feast, because our assumption is that indeed it is a meal that's celebrating his son's marriage, which therefore creates a significant possibility that there will be idolatrous sacrifices. So he can't attend that event. But mikan v'eilech, from here on, from after 30 days, if the idolater says that it's another meal to celebrate his son's marriage, then it would still be a problem. It would be prohibited to attend. But if he no longer is saying that he's having this feast for a wedding celebration, then we don't have to assume that's what it is, and therefore the Jew doesn't have to assume there'll be idolatrous sacrifices, so he could attend. The Gemara wonders, you know, how far does it go? Until what point? How long does this go on for, that if the idolater happens to mention, yeah, it's a celebration for his son's marriage, that, you know, then it would make it prohibited for the Jew to attend? How long does this continue for? Rav Papa said, it would extend for 12 months, for a year after the wedding. Beyond that, though, it would not be meaningful enough to warrant any, you know, prohibition. So that even if he says it's a celebration for his son's wedding, it wouldn't, you know, be meaningful, wouldn't be significant, and so the prohibition would not apply after that point. The Gemara now wonders, Meikara Meyemas Aser. What about before the wedding? What if this idolater invites a Jew to a meal, a feast, before the upcoming wedding? At what point would it be close enough for there to be a significant possibility that it's a meal celebrating the wedding, and therefore, you know, becomes a problem due to the possibility of idolatrous sacrifices? The Gemara answers, Amrav Papa Mishmei the Rava Michi Ramu Sarei Basinsi. For example, if they've already started to put the barley in the vats to produce beer for the wedding celebration, the point is they've begun the wedding preparations. If at this time he had a meal and invited a Jew, the Jew would not be able to attend because we would assume that the meal is celebrating the upcoming wedding, and therefore you have the problem of idolatrous sacrifices at that meal. More questions we said above. Rasks, is it true then that if it's already 12 months since the wedding, it's no longer a problem for a Jew to attend the idolater's meal? The Gemara asks from an anecdote of a heart of Yitzchak, Bereder of Misharshia, Ikla Lebeya, who Oved Kochavim. Once of Yitzchak, the son of a Misharshia, visited this idolater, Lebaser Tresiyachi Shasa, and this was over 12 months since the idolater had hosted a wedding for his son. Mishamei the Odi. Yitzchak overheard this idolater giving his thanks to his idol, and consequently, upirish v'lo achal, he abstained from eating further. It seems that it's only considered really attending a feast of an idolater if the Jew is also eating food, even if it's kosher food, as we mentioned above. So Yitzchak, when he realized that he was still at a problem here, he abstains from eating further so that he shouldn't be partaking of a meal. Again, even if he's eating his own food, but still he shouldn't also be eating at a meal celebration in which the host, the idolater, is giving thanks to his idol. So it seems from this story that there should be a problem even beyond 12 months from the wedding celebration. The Gemara answer is, Shaini Rav Yitzchak Breder Mesharshia De Adam Chashavu. Can't really extrapolate from this anecdote involving Rav Yitzchak by the Mesharshia, because it's different here since Rav Yitzchak was an Adam Chashav. He was a very prominent person, and it was the presence of this prominent person, Rav Yitzchak by the Mesharshia, that caused the idolater to go and thank his idol. So the problem there was specific to that case. You can't extrapolate this would be a problem in general. Rather, if it's beyond 12 months from the wedding celebration, the Jew does not have to assume that at the meal he's going to start worshiping his idol, and therefore it would not be forbidden for the Jew to also be eating in that meal. Of course, though, the food has to be kosher. The Mishnah mentioned another pagan festival of Kratesim. So the Gemara asks, "My Kratesim, Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Shmuel." It's referring to Yom Shetafsa Bo Romi Malchus. This day is a festival because it was the day in the year in which Rome took power. Gemara questions this interpretation, but Tanya B'dayit says in a Braisa, the Braisa lists Kartesim v'yom shetafsa bo Romi Malchus. It separately lists this Kartesim festival, and then it says, and also another festival is the day that Rome took power. The Gemara answers, Amar Rav Yosef said, Shtei tfisas tafsa Romi. There were two different stages where Rome significantly expanded their power. Achas bimei Cleopatra Malchusa, once in the days of Queen Cleopatra, and the Romans defeated Cleopatra. And this actually happened second historically. Achas shetafsa bimei Yevanim. Other day is celebrated because that was the day that they seized power from the Greeks. The Gemara elaborates on this event. The Chiasa Ravdimi Amr Ravdimi came from Eretz Yisrael to Bavel. He described the following event. Tlasin utrein kravi avdu romay vadei yivane veloyachlu lahu. So far the Romans had fought 32 battles against the Greeks and still could not overtake them. They were unable to defeat them. Ad shatfinu liyisrael badayu. Until the turning point was Rome entered into a pact with Yisrael. V'hachi asne badayu. They made the following pact with each other. They agreed, Iminon malchi minaychu yifarchi minaychu malchi minon yifarchi. They basically agreed to divide power so the Romans be victorious. So they made some kind of alliance here. Whereupon, v'shalchalu ramay liyavanei, the Romans sent the following message to the Greeks. Ad ha'idna avidna b'karava hashtena avid bedina. Up until now, we were trying to beat you just with our military skill, but now we shall defeat you in logic. It is that, a tide has turned here in our favor. For they posed to the Greeks, Margolis v'yevin tove, izimehen yase basas l'chavero. If it's between a pearl and a precious stone, which would be the basis, the setting, be underneath the other, be less than the other. Shalchalu, the Greek sends back, Margolis v'yevin tove, surely the pearl would be beneath the precious stone. Eventova v'yenach, Okay, what if you had a precious stone and then this very precious stone called Einach, a certain kind of, you know, very special gem, Ezemin Yaseh Basas Lachavero, which of these two would be the lower? Evan Tov Einach. The Greek said, surely the Evan Tov is not as precious as this Einach stone. Then the Romans asked the Greeks, Einach Vasefer Tara. Take the most precious stone you could find, this Einach stone. Compare that to a Sefer Torah, Ezemehen Yaseh Basas Lachavero, which is lower than the other. The Greeks answered, there's no question, Einach LeSefer Torah. However precious the stone may be, you cannot compare it to the value of the Torah. So this Einach stone would be, the setting would be below a Sefer Torah. The Romans said, well, now that we agree on that question, Shalchalo im kein anan sefer Torah gabon v'Yisrael ba'dan, we have to inform you that we now, having made this alliance of the Jews, we now have the Sefer Torah with us, this priceless tool, and now we shall surely defeat you. And that's what happened, Kafalahu. The Romans then defeated the Greeks. The Gemara relates, for Esun Vishishnin, Komalu Be'Menusayim by the Yisrael. The Romans kept their end of the deal for 26 years. However, Mikan V'Elach Ishtabde Behu. After 26 years, they said, forget it, and they subjugated the Jews. The Gemara says, Meikara Maidarsh V'Lubasov Maidarsh. So what was the change of heart here based on? What was the Romans' rationalization? The Gemara says, Meikara Darash. They made a drasha here. Initially, they expounded the pasuk, says the Chumash, Nisav in Eilecha v'yalcha l'negdecha. Esav beckoned Yaakov, let's travel together. I will travel next to you, says, implying that we'll be equals. So based on this pasuk, the Romans said, yes, it's proper that there should be essentially an equal division of power between us and the Jews. But ultimately, Rome found a different pasuk to darshan. And that was where Yaakov continued to Esav, that, no, I insist, Yaver na Adoni lifnei avdo. Please, my master, he said to his brother Esav, you should travel ahead of me. Go on, you don't need to travel next to me. So they took from this language that, look, you see, that Yaakov, the forefather of Yisrael, is subordinate to Esav, the forefather of Rome, and therefore it's only right that we subjugate the Jewish people, and that's what they did. Where it discusses this further, Esrin Vishis Shnin, the Kamubiyam Munusayim, but they Yisrael Minalan. From where do we know that the Romans were faithful to the agreement for that period of 26 years? The Gemara explains, the Amr of Kahana, for Rav Kahana said, Kishachola Rabbi Yishmol bar Yossi, and Rabbi Yishmol, the son of Yossi, became very ill, and Shalchulei, the Rabbanan, sent to him, Rebbe, Emralanu Shnaim Ushloshet Dvarim Shamartalanu Mishum Avicha. Please tell us two or three things that your father, Biosi, said. Amalahu, he said to them, one thing my father said was that Meya Ushmonim Shana Kodim Shenechav Abayis, for a period of 180 years before the second base of Migdash was destroyed, Pashta Malchus Arishal Yisrael, Rome ruled over Yisrael, they subjugated Yisrael for that time. Another historical event was Shmonim Shana Ad Locharav Abayis, 80 years before the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash, Gozru Toma Al Eretz Ha'amim B'Al Klei Zechuchis. The Rabbanan enacted, first of all, that merely by setting foot outside of Eretz Yisrael, that makes a person Tameh, because the peoples outside of Eretz Yisrael were not careful to track necessarily, you know, where they were burying people. And so one had to be concerned that maybe he did come into contact with a mace, the corpse became tummy from a corpse, and therefore there was like an automatic assumption that Rabbanan decreed a person goes outside Eretz Yisrael that he is considered tummy. Also, the Rabbanan extended the halach of tumma to kelim made from glass. Even though the Torah doesn't mention that glass could become tummy, the Rabbanan said that glass could become tummy. And Rabbi Yossi said further that Arbaim Shanad lo Charav Abayis Galsa Sanhedrin. 40 years before the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, the great Sanhedrin that until that point sat in the special Lishka Sagaz's chamber on the grounds of the Beis HaMikdash exiled itself, V'yashvala B'chanus, and relocated to Chanus, which was on Har Abayis, but not, you know, in the Lishka Sagaz's itself, which was like built into the Azara. My wonders about this last point, Lamai Hilchasa. Why was this halachically significant that the Sanhedrin Agadol relocated, and what was their purpose in relocating. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak bar Avdimi lomar shlo danu dine knasos. The result of the Sanhedrin relocating was that now they could no longer judge cases involving knasos. Of course, it means that we have, you know, a fixed monetary, you know, penalty for certain sins, certain actions, not commensurate to the actual damages. No, a scripturally decreed specific amount that applies for certain actions. The Gemara suggests that by removing themselves from the Lishkas HaGazis, that, you know, took the authority away from judges to judge cases involving knasos. The Gemara says, "Dine knasos akadaitach," but could that be true? "V'omer Rav Yehuda merav," but I, Rav Yehuda, said in the name of Rav, "Ram zachur oso ish letov." Surely the following individual will be remembered for good. Rav Yehuda ben Bava shemo. Rav Yehuda ben Bava will be remembered for good. Shel malihu nishtakhu dine knasos miYisrael. For were it not for this man, the laws of the knasos would be forgotten from the Jewish people. The Gemara wonders what this could mean. Nishtakhu, is that so? They would be totally forgotten. We'd forget the laws of the knasos. Why would that have ever happened? Ligarsinu. We simply continue learning these laws as part of the rest of the Torah that is still intact, that has been studied through the ages. The Gemara clarifies, "Ela but ludine knasos miYisrael." We're saying here is that we're not for Yehuda ben Bava's bravery, as we'll see about, the actual implementation of the laws of knasos would have ceased. For this is what happened. Shigazer malchus arisha gzera. The wicked kingdom of Rome made an evil decree against ordaining more rabbis with the formal smicha that we no longer have. Rome said, "Kol asomech yareg v'chol anismach yareg." First of all, the one who ordained and the person who was ordained will be killed. Not only that, v'ir shesomchin ba techrav, the whole city where the ordination happens will be destroyed. U'tchum shesomchin ba yaker, and the destruction will extend to the whole tchum boundary around that city. This was their extremely harsh decree to try and uproot the possibility that one would ever do the smicha anymore. So ma asar Yehuda ben Bava, what did Yehuda ben Bava do to circumvent the decree, at least as far as, you know, harming others? Holach v'yashav ben shnei harim gedolim. He went to a location between two big mountains, u'bein shnei yoros gedolos, between two cities, ben shnei tchumei shabbos, outside of either city's tchum boundary, so that, you know, other communities would not be put at risk by his action. Specifically, he went between Usha leShafram, between those two cities, but he wasn't, you know, close enough to either to put either of them in danger. V'samach sham, there he ordained Chamisha Zekenim, five elders, namely Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Elazar ben Shamua, Rav Avya, Moshe, Vav Rabbi Nechemia. According to Rav Avya, Rabbi Nechemia was also ordained at this time. His great Tanaim were ordained by Yehuda ben Bava at great peril to himself. More relates that this ceremony was discovered by the Romans, and when the enemies had discovered this and they were on the way to apprehend them, to put them to death, Amalar Mavidah ben Bava said to his students, "Bonai Rutsu, my sons, run." Amrulo, students said to the Rebbe, "Rebbe, v'atamat elacha, what will be of you?" Amalam, he said to them, "Don't worry about me, you go and run." I'm placed before you like a rock that can't be turned over. For whatever reason, Rabbi ben Bava, whether he was unable to escape or whether he wanted to stay there to fend off the approaching enemy, he remained and told his students to run. And they, you know, were able to run away and escape. But not Rabbi ben Bava, he remained. And they said, "Lo zozu misham atchenotzu legufo shlosh meas nios shel barzel asu legufo kikvara." It wasn't enough, you know, just to kill him. The Romans didn't leave until they pierced the Yehuda ben Bava with 300 spears, till they made his body into like a sieve. So Rabbi Yehuda Merav is saying that we have Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava to thank for the a continuation of the implementation of the laws of Knasos, meaning he gave his own life to give smicha to more rabbis to be able, apparently, to implement the laws of Knasos. Now, of course, these sages lived well after the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash. So it's clear that the possibility to implement the laws of the Knasos is not dependent on the Sanhedrin HaGadol being in its original location, Lishkas HaGazis. No. As long as the smicha is still alive, which it was at that time, it's possible to implement the laws of knasos. So how are we to understand, we said above, that the significance of the Sanhedrin leaving Lishkas HaGazis was that it impacted the laws of Knesset? Not true. As long as the judge in question has the smicha, he could implement the laws of Knesset. So the Gemara modifies, Amar Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak lo tema dine Knesset. We're not saying the laws of Knesset, ele shelo donu dine nefashos. Rather, the point here is that by exiling themselves from Lishkas HaGazis, now the courts can no longer implement the death penalty. They can no longer try capital cases. My taima. Why do they make this decision? The Gemara explains, Kivin de chazu de nefishin lehu rotzchin, when they saw that unfortunately things got to such a bad state that there was a proliferation of murder among our people to the point that v'layachlu lemeidan, they weren't able to handle all of the cases. They wouldn't be able to properly try all of these murderers. Therefore, Amru, they came to the decision, they said, Mutav nigle mimakom lemakom kihechid lo lechaivu. Better that we should exile ourselves out of the Lishkas HaGazis and thereby take away our power to try capital cases. Because given the current climate, it's not possible to process all the cases properly, and therefore they left the Lishkas HaGazis. For indeed, if the Sanhedrin HaGadol is not sitting in the Lishkas HaGazis, no court is able to prosecute to try a capital case, the Chsiv. It says in the Pasuk, V'yasisa al pi adaver sher yagidu lecha min ha-mako mahu. You shall listen to whatever they say, referring to the Supreme Sanhedrin, the Sanhedrin HaGadol. Whatever they tell you to do from that place that Hashem chooses, which is a reference to the Lishkas HaGazis chamber in the Beis HaMikdash where the Sanhedrin sat. From this terminology, we learn, Melamed, it teaches us, Shehamakom Gore. The Pasuk is saying that the place itself causes the court to have their full powers, Sanhedrin HaGadol. It is that the Sanhedrin HaGadol, being in that place that Hashem chose, Lishkas HaGazis, is a prerequisite in order for them to have that full authority, that is to try capital cases. That is why, upon leaving the Lishkas HaGazis, now Sanhedrin no longer is able to judge capital cases. Coming back now to the main point, Yossi is saying that Rome ruled over Eretz Yisrael for 180 years before the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash. The Gemara now points out, Mea Ushmonim Visu Lo. Is it true that the Romans only ruled over Eretz Yisrael for 180 years? But Ayviotani Rabbi Yossi Barebi. Ayb Yossi Barebi said as follows. Continuing now to Tesamin Aleph. Malchus Paras Bifnei Abayas Shloshim V'yar B'shanam. We had Persian rule of Eretz Yisrael during the era of the second Beis HaMikdash, followed by Malchus Yavan Bifnei Abayas Meo Shmonim Shana. We were under Greek rule for the next 180 years, followed by Malchus Chashmonai Bifnei Abayas Meo V'shalosh. When the Jews defeated the Greeks, it ushered in a period of 103 years of the Chashmonai rule, but there was also significant Roman influence at this time, followed by Malchus Beis Hurdus Meya Vishalish. Hurdus took power and his dynasty continued for 103 years. Again, this was also under significant Roman influence. And these different periods bring us to the total of 420 years that the second Bayis stood, and at that point the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed by Rome. Mikan V'yelech, from here on, the Brisa instructs that whoever's teaching this Brisa should calculate how many years it's been since the second Beis HaMikdash, that we're still waiting for a Mashiach, for the final redemption. The point is, Alma Masan Vishesavu. Clearly, from Rabbi Yossi Barebi's teaching, we see that the Roman influence, the Roman rule, was for a period of 206 years. When we combine the last two periods of Chashmonai, of 103, and Beis Hurdus of another 103. So how does this jibe with what we said above? We suggested that the Roman rule was for 180 years. So this brings us to the point of, while we quoted all of this, but the Gemara says, Ella, rather must be, Esrin Vishis Shnin Kamu V'Emunusayu Bade Yisrael V'lo Yishtab Debehu. The resolution is because for 26 out of the above 206 years of Roman rule, the Romans did not subjugate the Jews. They kept up their end of the deal and maintained their alliance with Yisrael. Therefore, Bishmal didn't include those years in his count of Roman domination over Yisrael. That is the basis of his statement above of Kishapashta Machas or Rasha Yisrael, that Rome ruled over Yisrael for 180 years, because he subtracted the 26 years for which they did keep to their agreement not to subjugate Yisrael.
You've been listening to RealClearDaf.com. Visit us online for resources or to dedicate a shiur. To speak with Rabbi Wise, call 855-ASK-RCD-1. That's 855-275-7231.